Today on What's Missing, we're very lucky to have the chance to speak with Dr. Sarah Wayland. Sarah is a social worker and renowned researcher from the University of Sydney. She has been working in the missing person space since 2004, when she was the first permanent counsellor for the Families and Friends of Missing Persons Unit. In 2005, Sarah was the recipient of a Churchill Fellowship and spent months in the USA working closely with Emeritus Professor Pauline Boss, who coined the term ambiguous loss in 1999. Sarah is Australia's oracle on the topic of missing persons, providing expert comment and interviews to various media outlets about the experience of loss for families of missing people. She lectures in the Sydney School of Health Sciences, teaching in the areas of introduction to health, health and lifelong disability, and qualitative research methods. Her research interests relate to suicide prevention, suicide postvention, returned missing people, and mental health recovery. Her PhD study, I Still Hope, But What I Hope For, has now changed, a narrative inquiry study exploring hope and ambiguous loss, was awarded the Chancellor's Medal for doctoral research at the University of New England in October 2015. Due to the large number of repeat missing incidents, particularly regarding younger people, Sarah is passionate about exploring the untapped potential in conducting return home interviews. She is currently leading a pilot program for Missing Persons Advocacy Network, MPAN, around training practitioners in the specifics of ambiguous loss, so that families of long-term missing persons can receive specialised support. She is also travelling to Scotland this year as part of an international partnership grant to work with Professor Hester Parr, the leader of the Geographies of Missing People project. Sarah joins me in the studio now to enlighten us with her expertise on ambiguous loss and the liminal space where hope and despair shift on a fluctuating basis. There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. There's a hole in my heart the size of an island. Islands can be big and small, my love, for you will never go away. I guess I'll just jump in with, how on earth did you end up in this very obscure line of work?
Well, that's a long story.
We've got
probably
time.
A short story as well. I started working as a social worker 20 years ago now. So half my lifetime working in responding to people significantly traumatized by a whole range of life events. I went straight from school to uni. I studied social work purely because I didn't want to be a nurse, but I liked helping people, but I didn't like blood. So I thought social work was a really nice segue to get all involved in people's lives. So I spent probably 4 or 5 years after graduating just kind of jumping from job to job, country to country, really enjoying working with people where I had an opportunity to hear their story. So I landed a job back in Sydney. I'd moved back here from, I think, New Zealand at that stage in about 2003, and I was working for the domestic violence line, which was a 24-hour line where there was only one counsellor working overnight. And you were locked in a building in Parramatta with your phone, responding to phone calls from women highly distressed, organising taxis to remove women from really precarious situations. And so quite understandably, I found the job useful, but I knew it wasn't sustainable for me as a person. So I was flicking through the newspaper on a night shift and I saw an ad that came up about a 3-month position in a new service called the Families and Friends of Missing Persons Unit. And I think, like all true listeners of podcasts, I've always been really interested in the stories of crime and the stories of what actually happens for people. And so in my life growing up, my mum was fixated with the Azaria Chamberlain case. And she had her theories, she had her ideas. She read every memoir that came out. She read every authorised or unauthorised biography. And I guess from her, I inherited my understanding of how we try and make sense of the world around us by understanding the mysteries of other people. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring here. I don't have specific missing persons experience. And it was if the universe, you know, I'm not a spiritual person necessarily, but it was if the spirit, the universe delivered to me this position where they said, you know what, you don't have any skills in working with families of missing people, but you seem like a really nice, compassionate person. And you seem like someone that's got a lot of energy. So come for 3 months, let's just see how it goes. So I took the job, and on the very first day of working there, I had a manager who had taken annual leave on my first day. So I turned up at a job with a book on my desk and a little post-it note that said, best of luck. These are the people that have called. It was a new service responding to families of missing people. So it was funded by New South Wales Attorney Generals. And they said, these are the people that have rung in anticipation for a counsellor coming on board. Read this book and then call the families. And the book was called Ambiguous Loss by Emeritus Professor Pauline Boss. And I read the book in a day and I thought, I'm home. Wow. And so from there, I really worked out that this was my life's work. So it sounds a bit like Oprah, but, you know, sometimes the universe delivers what you actually need.
Absolutely.
And at the life stage I was at, I must have been, I don't know, 25, it really felt like I was ready to grow into who I was supposed to be. And so I started working with families of missing people and I haven't stopped.
So that was 2003?
That was 2000, right at the beginning of 2004.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then when was it that you ended up applying for a Churchill Fellowship and getting it and going over to the States?
So it was actually the following year. And looking back now, I think only a 25-year-old would go, I've done this job for a year. I might as well be an international expert. I don't have any reason to believe that I'm an international expert, but I'll give it a go. So a year later, I applied, and I can remember as clear as day, I applied because I had a sense that I was very much working in isolation in Sydney. There was no other service of its kind. I was responding to families of missing people who had waited years, decades sometimes, to talk to someone who understood what their unique loss experiences were like. I was working with police who were crying out for a referral pathway to give families something other than the policing experience. And so I applied for a Churchill Fellowship to study the international approach to counselling and unresolved loss. And so actually the reason behind it was I had become fixated with Pauline Boss's book and I wanted to meet her because this was back in the day where we didn't have Skype, we couldn't FaceTime. I had a little picture of her on the back of the book, and like we all know, the picture and the person don't always look like the same thing. But she'd been very kind to me via email and we'd had a lot of to and fro conversations where I said to her, I don't sometimes think that grief and bereavement approach of working with families of missing people is the right thing to do, but I'm at a loss sometimes as to how to manage their distress because I was situated in victims of crime at that stage, where the service still currently sits. But some of the families that were coming to see me would be howling, crying so loud that would have colleagues come past and open my door just to double check that I was okay because they would hear the noise down the hallway. And these weren't people who had someone most recently gone missing. These were people that were 3, 4, 5 years down the track, but nobody had ever said to them, tell me about the person that's missing. Tell me about what it's like for you to live with not knowing. So I think it must have been the following February I applied for the Churchill Fellowship, or maybe a few months before. And as luck would have it, because I have this thing that happens with the universe, I found out that I was accidentally pregnant with my daughter one morning, and then 2 hours later, the Churchill Fellowship people rang and said, congratulations, you can go for 3 months overseas. And it was scheduled for the time when I was supposed to be giving birth to this child that I hadn't actually planned.
Oh, my gosh.
So it felt opportunistic in the way where I thought, you know what, this is a really crucial time in my life and why not give it a try? So I delayed it by 6 months. I had my beautiful daughter, Poppy, and I popped her on my back and we went off and did the Churchill Fellowship together when she was 7 months old.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you rocked up in the States. Whereabouts was it?
So I went to the University of Minnesota. I spent a week with Pauline Boss, who is the most beautiful person you could ever meet, and her lovely husband, Dudley. And I would have dinner in their home and they would feed Poppy. And my mum was traveling with me to help me look after her. And we would talk through the complexity of how you provide evidence-based support to families of missing people. And she helped me develop a framework that could be used here in Australia. I then travelled to Montreal and met with a support group that was running there at the time for families of missing persons, which was really lovely to see that group work approach that's now been taken on board at Families and Friends of Missing Persons Unit. I travelled to the UK, to Missing People UK, back when it had just gotten a huge amount of funding from Richard Branson, so they were really taking off. And then I travelled to Ireland, to Missing in Ireland Support Services. And I had this idea that it would be this service where they were doing wonderful things. It was a group of four older people who had someone who'd gone missing and they just wanted to change things. And so they were out there trying to train up police, organising volunteers, doing wonderful things. So, yeah.
What a whirlwind, gosh.
Yeah.
And with a baby.
I know.
Far out, Sarah. Amazing.
I know. Very impressive. Think I was just, yeah, I didn't think things through consistently, and that's always worked for me. So I'm sticking with it.
Brilliant. Brilliant methodology there. So Pauline Boss coined this term ambiguous loss. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what year that was.
She wrote the book in 1999, but she'd been working since the 70s on a concept of ambiguous loss after working as a family therapist in terms of thinking about soldiers who were missing in action and what happens for the families that are left behind. But also personally for her, she was thinking about her own migration experience to America and what it meant to leave behind family members. Even though they were still physically present, she felt psychologically disconnected from them. So she very much merged together that sense, and I think that's so important for researchers, that sense of we come with our own lived experience, but we also add in our professional experience. And if you bring the two of them together really nicely, then you can do really good work.
I think that the first time a family member of a missing person hears the term ambiguous loss, they feel seen.
Yes.
And it's just so incredibly validating. I remember I first heard it from you.
Yeah.
When I met you, I think the first time I met you would have been 2012, I think. Were you at the, there was a Griffith University conference?
Yes.
And I was just like a deer in headlights because I was the only family member, I think, apart from the Morecambes. And I just rocked up because I was just craving any knowledge, any information about this issue, and I found out about it online somehow, and I just rocked up at the uni, and it's, you know, all of you intimidating academics. And then I got chatting with you and I was like, wow, a real life person who knows about this thing, and there was a name for it, and that was so powerful.
I do actually remember that meeting, and I remember how important it was. I remember you coming up to me and saying, where are all the other families? Where are they? You know, and I think irrespective of what work I do as a counsellor, managing services, being a researcher, it's all about connection and belonging. And I think as a counsellor, your job is to be the vehicle to say, I've met other families like you and I see you and I see what's happening for you. And there's sometimes nothing more fancy than that. And I know that probably a lot of counselling associations and fancy pants people will say, no, it's more than that. But at the end of the day, people want to have an opportunity to tell their story and to know that some aspects of their story are replicated in other people with the same experiences and that those people have survived.
Exactly.
Because people are grasping for an opportunity to understand this terrible, terrible things happened to me and nobody gets it. But I can see that there's this family that are championing what's going on for me. There's this family that's 10 years on. There's this family that are standing up in the media. And there's a lot of invisible threads between families of missing people. They don't all have to be attending support groups. They don't have to know each other, but they have to know that each other exists.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I was so desperate to know that other people existed. And I didn't at that stage. That was a year into Dan's disappearance and I still hadn't met a family.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe that none of them were there. But in hindsight, it was an academic conference. I wasn't thinking clearly.
No. And I do remember before that reading a piece that you'd done online. And I contacted the person who wrote the piece or had been connected in some ways to editing the piece, because I felt so strongly about how much you needed a buddy. And I said, this person needs to know that there are services out there and that there are people like me that are happy to talk to them. But I think that what I realised, because there's an impact on me constantly exposed to other people's trauma, is that we need to do better in the community to have multiple places for people to connect with support, not relying on being reactive all the time. Because that had to rely on me reading your piece. It had to rely on me going, you know what, this isn't very orthodox, but I'm going to email that person and say, did you know? I still find it very difficult when I see a family member of a missing person in the media or on social media saying, we're alone, we don't know what to do, and not to try and jump in and fix it all of the time. So I think that, yeah, I guess I don't always have the answers, but I think we know a lot about missing persons now, but there are still families that are significantly distressed because more and more people continue to go missing. So I think I get why you turned up at an academic conference, because in the absence of anything else, what else were you supposed to do?
It is very isolating. And even knowing that there are families, like through this process this week, we've had a number of families come in and they've had varying lengths of time in this space of ambiguity, and they still feel completely isolated. Like FFMPU exists and MPAN exists, and it takes a lot of energy though to then connect.
Yes.
With them.
Yes.
And you've still got that notion that, you know, your story is different to theirs. Mm. But knowing that we do exist, I can't tell you how much lighter I felt after speaking with you the first time,
yeah.
Sarah.
Yeah.
You are invaluable to all of the people that find themselves living this nightmare, to know that you exist and that you have still 15 years on, 20 almost,
yeah.
This drive to help people like us.
Well, I think, you know, when you're trained as a social worker, you're trained to be an agent of change. Social workers get a pretty bad rap in the media, you know, that we either snatch children away from people's homes or that we're just the cup of tea provider and we have a chat and we organise what happens when you go home from hospital. But what is deeply embedded in being a social worker is a human rights lens. Is about acknowledging injustice where you see it and working really hard to unpack it. And I think missing persons is not a unique space in the sense that there is still so much to be done. But once you see it, you can't unsee it. And so I think it would be almost more problematic for me to know all of this and not want to do something than to be working hard at trying to do stuff. You know, I do a lot of work in terms of clinically supervising other trauma workers, so people that work in the trauma space, about acknowledging what their protective behaviours are. And the most protective behaviour for me is I feel valued by the work that I do. I'm not doing it so that I get value, but I feel valued because I know that I'm adding to an evidence base, that I'm trying to shift things. But also, it takes me 2 seconds to reply to somebody's text message, or it takes me a few minutes to Google something and send a link to somebody. Like, that's not a huge imposition on your day. You think of how much time everybody wastes sitting in meetings that could have been emails. You know, I spend a lot of those meetings replying to emails for other things because that's where I see the value.
Absolutely. It means the world. Mm. It means the absolute world.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of research in this niche field. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the research that you've done.
So back when I was explaining about my entry into the missing persons sector, I know that it's not a very nice term, but it is a space. So that was 2004. Churchill 2005-ish, six, with a little buddy along the way. And then I went to the Australian Federal Police after I finished my Churchill and did a year with them, turning my Churchill Fellowship findings into a framework to help other counsellors. What we found was that when people reached out for counselling after somebody went missing, they could be traumatised by the skills of the counsellor. And that might sound a little bit rough and kind of like I'm pulling down my own profession, but when I started working with families, they would say, look, I saw a generalist counsellor in my local area, and they were horrified that, you know, that this happens. They made suggestions like, have you reported the person to the police? Like really kind of like eye roll moments. One person who stands out significantly said that they saw a grief and bereavement counsellor, and that counsellor suggested that they hold a mock funeral to seek closure around the loss of the missing person.
So
much of the counselling work that I'd started doing was unpacking the issues of what happened when people reached out for support. So we developed a counselling framework that meant that it was just online, so that if you got a referral in whatever community mental health role that you had, and the person was presenting because of complexities around having someone missing, we kind of hoped that people would Google what was going on, and then it was just five top tips kind of thing in terms of how to respond to families of missing people. So I did that, and then I returned back to families and friends of missing persons unit. And you know how you kind of can't go back to an old workplace? So I kind of got itchy feet going back and started to think, what could I do next? So I was managing the service, and I knew that if I stayed, I would just end up being a public service manager, and no disrespect, there's nothing the matter with that. But I just don't think I wear the right clothes to have that sort of a job. That I have the right mindset to be good at admin and staff management. I just felt like it shouldn't be the reward for being good at your job that you no longer get to work with people. And so I had a second baby, so my little boy who was born in 2010. And I thought while I was on maternity leave, I'm going to start my master's. So that's what I did when he was about 4 months old. And yes, I acknowledge I have a problem with just being on maternity leave, but I tried a mother's group. It didn't work for me.
Masters instead.
I started my master's. I connected with a really renowned suicide researcher, Professor Miff Maple. And it turned out, you know, like the universe keeps delivering for me, it turned out we'd actually done our undergraduate social work degree together, and she became my supervisor. And managed to dazzle University of New England, and they allowed me to trade up to the PhD program out of the master's before finishing it. So I got a PhD scholarship, and I said, thank you very much to the public service. I will be on my way. It's been nice. And I wore Birkenstocks ever since then because the clothing issue was really important for me about, you know, really replicating what my true value was. And so I started to think about what were the counselling issues that really kind of rubbed up against me around providing support to families of missing people. And it always came back to a sense of stuckness around the concept of hope. I've always been a big consumer of media. God bless podcasts being developed because, you know, that's how I consume my media now. But back then it was reading things and, you know, watching documentaries and reading first-person narratives. And I noticed that there was a continual focus on this sense of, this paternalistic sense of the need to hold on to hope if you were the family member of a long-term missing person. And I knew in the counselling space, the secret stories that families had shared with me, that it wasn't that simple. And so that's what I did my PhD on. I interviewed 19 families of a long-term missing person. They ranged from 7 or 8 months. I can remember a woman talking about her partner at the time that was missing. And the longest I interviewed, there was a family who had a daughter who'd been missing for 35 years. So I talked to them around what do we understand hope to mean in terms of the social discourse of hope. You know, hope is very solution-focused. It's very outcome-focused. You know, we hope to do well in an exam, or we hope that our kids will grow up to be nice people. But when it comes to family members of missing people, we talked about what were the public narratives of hope and what were the private narratives of hope. And so that really kind of set me on a path of developing a really clear research agenda around what we don't talk about in the missing person space. And when we don't talk about it, how much it silences families of missing people and how much it silences missing people themselves.
I just remembered reading, I don't know how it even ended up in my hands, but a copy of A Glimmer of Hope.
Yes.
Was that the little booklet that you wrote? Yeah. When was that?
That was actually 2005.
Okay.
That was a big year for me, apparently.
Huge year.
Yeah, thought I'd have a baby, do a Churchill Fellowship, write a book.
It was so important for me to, again, to have something tangible to tell me that I wasn't alone in this and other people were living it. And it is interesting that that notion of hope and its importance, especially in the context of when you've got a missing loved one, and how that hope can change over time. You know, initially, of course, you hope that it's just they're blowing off some steam or they're going to come home in a couple of days, or then you just hope that they're okay. You hope that eventually, you know, maybe at Christmas they'll walk back through the door. Then you just hope that one day you know, and then you can hope that even it's hard to get to that point, but that if remains are washed up or found in the bush or and your ears prick up in the media as soon as that happens, you worry and you dread that call, but you also hope for it. So it's a weird place to be in.
Yes. And it's almost like a bit of a Venn diagram of hopefulness and hopelessness and how you move between that kind of shared hope zone. I think what was revealed by a lot of families was that there were kind of two streams of hope, and that there was hope for the missing person themselves, hope that they were okay, that they were warm, that they were happy, that they were confident with the choices they'd made if they were intentionally missing, that they weren't at continued risk, that if they were a victim of a crime, that they were being treated nicely. But what was something that I had never had the opportunity, because when you're in the counselling space, you have to be guided by what the person is talking about. Like you can, you're not going to manipulate the conversation for your own interests. Whereas as a researcher, you can probe those issues because you've been very clear ethically about this is the context that I want to talk to you about, but I want to keep pulling down until I get my complete understanding with what you're talking about. And so for the first time, families were starting to reveal something we'd never seen in any other research around missing persons, is that they wanted to talk about the hope for themselves, the hope for their capacity to survive, not knowing, the hope that they didn't grow old and pass away and never know what happened. And that's always, for me, that's always such a sad realization when I work with families for a really long time. And then I find out that they've passed away and they never knew. And then they're worried about making sure that who's the next person in the family that will kind of, you know, carry the torch and be the contact person and push the police. And so that kind of shared hopefulness as well as space for really honest shared hopelessness was so important. Because for some families, they said that they didn't feel confident to be able to say outwardly, you know what, I don't think I have any hope anymore that this person will come back. But the media want me to say I'm holding on to hope at all costs. My family want me to say, of course I'm holding on to hope. But you know what? I gave up on hope a long time ago because that's my protective mechanism. Because I want to say that, you know, I joked with my PhD supervisors that I wanted to say that, you know, kind of hope is crap. That's what I wanted the PhD to be called. Because by the end, I was like, if I have to think about hope one more time, I don't know what I'm going to write here. But I kept going back to the families and I kept going back to the transcripts in terms of trying to understand, well, if they're two different ideas of hope, do they intersect? And if they're two stories, do they sit alone? But they do intersect, but they intersect at different times. So like you said, when you hear a story in the media about, you know, remains have washed up on this beach, I automatically know myself how many families that I've worked with will go, oh, hang on, what beach? What condition are the bones in? Could that be ours? And then that raising of hope. And then one lovely participant in my study talked about a hope hangover, that he was anticipating so much that there would be an answer that he was let down. But then there was the reality of, hang on, I'm let down, that human remains are not my human remains that I'm searching for. And then all of a sudden you feel like, am I even part of the world exactly. where this is my reality?
How on earth did I get here?
Yes, exactly, yeah. exactly.
You thrust into this situation. No one is ever prepared to yeah. find out that their loved one has just vanished. And then all of a sudden you've got, yeah, really morbid, dark things that are happening that you're associating with. Mm. Like I noticed lots of changes when Dan was missing, and I would be hyper alert to especially media reports of bodies and remains being found. And, you know, even to the extent that when I'm out in public and I see something in the shrubs over there, is that a body? And that never used to be my world.
Yes.
But now it is. And yeah. I'm, you know, liaising with all different types of families with different types of cases. And I am constantly thinking of that. And it's weird.
It is really weird. And when I noticed, you know, when I travel with my family or, you know, we're driving through a town, I don't look out and think, what a beautiful town. I think, I remember that long-term missing persons case from here. Like my holiday memories are attached to the places that I've been to support families.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality is I've learned over the years that it's okay to joke with families. You know, you pick your times.
Yeah.
You don't, it's not the first thing you say when you walk in.
Yeah.
But it's okay to say, you know, your worldview has been completely shattered.
Mm.
And it might not be that prevalent forever. You know, you might not always look at a bush and think, is that a body popping out from there? But you might realize that there is more to every story than what we know, and that everyone is walking around with all of these layers of trauma that as a community, we are not very good at understanding. So we use the platitudes like, well, you need to hold on to hope, or we use the platitudes like, you know, that sense of being relieved when remains are found, and that it's not as simple as that. And I think for me, in terms of how that's shaped my life, families of missing people have allowed me to build my own ideas about how the world works. And I feel like I'm both far more compassionate but far more fiery at the same time, because there's a lot of injustices that happen with people when someone opens their mouth and they haven't thought through what they're going to say to them. And it sticks with families of missing people for a long time. Throwaway lines that people make. It's like, you know, we've done a lot of media together over the years, and, you know, when people ring in and, you know, and they try and create a grief hierarchy of, well, your story isn't as bad as this story. Well, you know what? It's actually not a competition. It's all just lived experience. And if it's the most catastrophic thing for one family, then that's their catastrophe.
Absolutely. But people just aren't exposed to that. They don't know. There's no education around it. You know, ambiguous loss is still relatively unknown as a term.
Yeah.
So we've got a long way to go yet.
We do. We do. And I think it's nice to see a lot of research emerging, particularly from the UK, but even from here in Australia, University of Wollongong is doing some research. And I think understanding the presentations of families of missing people means that the clinical interventions that you use with them are going to be better. So we now know that families of missing people present as if they're having post-traumatic stress disorder, but the post-traumatic stress disorder is around grief ruminations. So if you put that in layperson's language, it's imagined ideas as to what happened to the missing person. So they not only have just one area to be panicked about, but if you don't have enough information, then you're also going to add in 10 more other stories that you play out in your mind, because there's not enough evidence for you to have a definitive idea as to what happened to this person.
And that's day in, day out,
yeah.
for years, sometimes decades. And that manifests in a variety of ways. I know we were fortunate to have resolution after 4.5 years, but I noticed, you know, my memory was shot by
yes.
the end of it. Like there are real consequences to this, physically, mentally, emotionally. It's exhausting every day wondering, what about this? What about that? I mean, the whole situation is unbelievable. So therefore, every outcome is just as plausible and unlikely and insane. But Maybe it did. You just don't know.
And we also don't take into account the intergenerational trauma that some people might experience. If we're talking about the high incidence of missing in Aboriginal communities, we also have to take into account the trauma that people face in terms of social determinants of health, in terms of political interventions, in terms of poverty. Like, it's not just as simple as I'm this person and missing happened to me. There can be a whole host of other issues. It's not as simple as saying just talk to the police either, because that's not always going to give you all of the answers. And it's also about mastering that sense of not knowing. And I don't know anyone that's any good at that. I was just reflecting with a colleague, thinking back to some bereavement that I experienced last year. I said to her that I thought a few weeks in, I've spent my whole career, you know, being the poster person for ambiguous loss, and I've just worked out that I am terrible at not knowing. And I think that that's an important reflection, that it's not like if you work hard at it that you'll achieve success in terms of, you know, I don't know, a gold star in terms of responding to ambiguous loss. It's a lifelong process. It's working out how much is enough, how much information is going to be enough, and what parts am I going to have to recognise that I have no power and control over whether or not this person is found or whether or not I find the answers. And in my PhD study, I asked families, well, how do you find meaning in the midst of all of that? You know, a lot of people spoke about spirituality. A lot of people spoke about really focusing in on their own self-care because that was the only thing that they could control. They couldn't control when the police were going to call. They couldn't control what the media were going to report about their missing person. They couldn't do a lot of things, but they could control whether or not they went for a walk every day, whether or not they did things in terms of just kind of nourishing themselves and looking after themselves and being kind to themselves when it wasn't a good day.
The fact that it doesn't get easier over time has been a consistent theme throughout this project. Yeah. And everyone has different ways of coping, so mm-hmm. that the goal is really to just get better at coping with living with ambiguous loss. And my coping mechanism was definitely to be proactive.
Yes.
And to feel like I was doing everything that I could possibly do to try and find Dan. And then when it got to a point where that hopelessness really took over and, you know, we'd done the billboards, we'd done the media, we'd done everything that I could think of in that first 12, 18 months, that's when I kind of decided I had to step back and look at the bigger picture because despite my best efforts, I still couldn't find him. And I'm not sure that I could have continued much longer going at that pace. But everyone has a different way of coping with tragedy. In all of your years of experience, what are some of the stories that have stuck with you from families?
It's interesting. I feel like I'm a walking story repository some of the time. And I've always used stories in counselling. I speak very little about clinical interventions or what the theories or the literature says. I'll say I've worked with another family and they did X, Y, and Z, because as a counsellor, you're the vehicle between the clients, not necessarily the person that just gives a textbook response. There's been lots of stories that have really stuck with me, and it's interesting. Sometimes I can remember the faces of the people that have told me the stories, or I'll remember the missing person themselves. I used to spend a lot of time wondering what would happen if I had a chance to talk to the missing person, because I always feel like, you know, there's three people in the room and the third person is missing, like technically, but also from the conversation. I always wanted to get a sense of, well, what are your thoughts about this story? What are your thoughts about what's not being said about you? You know, what would happen if we invited you into this conversation? And so clearly I've never been able to resolve that in terms of having that three-way conversation. But very early on when I started collecting stories and writing them down, there was a family that spoke to me about the fact that their son was missing. And he had been missing for probably 2.5 years at the time. And they used to spend their weekends searching the national park for him. And they contacted me kind of laughing about it at the time. But they said, we just actually realised today that we wouldn't know what we were supposed to do if we did find his remains here. And we just realised that we spend our weekends walking around looking for our son's body. And almost the ridiculousness and the trauma of that is just astounding, because it's not like we're talking about something that happened a week ago where there's a higher likelihood of success. We're continually looking for something that's probably the most morbid, traumatic thing that we can do, but we don't know what else to do because there is no rule book. We don't know where to put our grief. We don't have any finality. We don't have any rituals that we can use. The media are no longer interested in talking to us because we don't have any new angle to share. We've just kind of become a little bit of a wasteland. And so this is what we try and do in terms of channeling our energy. And I remember, you know, talking them through about, okay, well, let's see if we can find some practical information about if you do locate something, what should you do? Like, how will we know to return back to that spot? But also connecting them with other families that had been doing similar searches over the years. I'm always encouraged by the lengths that families will go to continue to search for somebody. It doesn't matter if they've travelled to another country or who they see or where they might be. Even if they're popping into a town to do something that they don't normally do, they'll just quickly have a look, just scanning the crowds just to double check. And one of the mums that I worked with, and I don't want anyone to think that I'm sharing counselling stories without permission. There are a few stories that I tell that I sought permission from the families I've worked with. But there was one lovely mum who used to travel through the city of Sydney on her way to work one day a week. And she walked past a billboard with a rotating Calvin Klein model advert there, and she was convinced it was her son. And she rang me from a payphone back then. That's how long ago this story was. I think I had a mobile, I was an early adopter. But she rang me and she said, I think I found him, because she was convinced that the image of the model was her son. And she then created this whole narrative about, well, that makes sense now why I haven't seen him, because I know that these adverts are filmed in America, so that's why I haven't seen him here. He must have left the country very quickly. We'll have to check the flight schedules. We'll have to work out where he was. It's definitely him. She had a digital camera. She'd taken photos. She came into the office to show me. And it was the space where I started to think about how important it is for a counsellor to have a safe outlet to talk about their work too, because I was in that moment where I knew straight away that it wasn't her son, but I didn't want to be the person that said, that's not your son, because she was so excited and she'd been so distressed for so many years. And our counselling sessions had always gone around and around the same thing, understandably, because she had no resolution, she had nothing, no anchor point for her to make sense of what had happened. And I just remember thinking, oh God, I wish someone would remove me from this room because I don't want to be the teller. So I waited, I leaned across the table and I took her hand and I said, you know that that's not him. And she said to me, I know, but can we just pretend for a little while longer? And I still think how powerful that was. And I said to her, I know, I really, really want it to be him too. And I don't even know him. But I just think it speaks volumes to the fact that how spectacularly unfair it is to have something happen to you and have no one to be able to solve it for you. And I think that's why we need to tell the true stories of families left behind, because it's not as simple as, you know, a crime drama. It's really, really awful and it's torture for families. And that's why, you know, people get frustrated and say, you know, oh, they're still returning to the same story. They're still telling the stuff, because they want to keep saying it until someone hears them and does something about it. And I just think how powerful that is. But I also recognised at the point when I was doing that work that if I want to make a change, I have to go bigger and I have to be in the research space, because it's easy to be protected in the counselling room and just hear stuff and say, wow, that's really awful. But if you don't make it bigger, then nothing's ever going to change, because it just becomes silent stories that nobody ever acknowledges. So I'm sorry that I just made you cry.
No, I've been crying all day. It's weird because, like, I guess I'm wearing two hats and I'm professional and I'm a family member.
So. You are. You are, and you always will be.
Mm.
And I know a lot of families I've worked with where they've had resolutions. And sometimes their primary panic is, do I still get to be part of this group? Do I still get to seek support from these people?
Mm-hmm.
Am I classed as the one that had a good end? And this is where I think, in what world is a good end where somebody's body is located? It's just the beginning of a whole other awful story. I think we have to value the stories, but we need to tell them in meaningful ways. Because otherwise it just gets chalked up to, wow, that's an interesting mystery. And that's all that people are interested in. Soon after I finished my PhD, you kind of get pushed as an academic to be on that path of publishing and thinking about what next. And I was kind of working in the justice health field at the time, just waiting for the dust to settle because it's hard work doing a PhD. But I wrote a piece for Lancet Psychiatry on the mysticism of missing persons because it was the 50th anniversary of Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Oh, yeah.
And for a lot of people, that's their introduction into missing persons, this kind of mystical Kate Bush dancing around in a long dress, in the hills.
Yeah.
Girls with long blonde hair and us just thinking it's just a story and that there's some magical power that will one day resolve all of the issues. And I think that that does a real disservice to what I see happening on the ground because it's not mystical and there's no soundtrack playing in the background and no one has nice dresses and nice hair, It's sad and you have to be in the trenches with people.
Mm.
And, there are a lot of families that have used proactivity as a coping strategy. But we shouldn't rely on the sector moving forward by people having to step up when they have lived experience.
Mm.
So I'm really passionate about that. I think that there's a space for proactivity and lived experience, but there also has to be a space for policy and programs and practices and whatever other P words you can think of.
Yeah.
To shift that dynamic and to see this for what it is as a public health crisis. Not a matter of, whoops, they're missing, wow, we found them.
Yeah, that's one of the many, many things I wanted to cover with you is the fact that it is seen, especially in Australia, I feel, as it's a police issue. So if someone goes missing, you report them missing to police and that's where it sits. And the expectation is on the police to search for them and find them. But that's not the reality of it.
No.
How do you want to see the way that this topic of missing persons is perceived, changed?
Look, I think there are lots of different threads and I try not to get ahead of myself now. I feel like I've grown up alongside working in this sector. And I think that there's benefit in being loud and angry, but there's also benefit in being considered and strategic. I think with my strategic hat on, I think that we need to know more about the missing persons population in order to prevent people from going missing. We also need to challenge ourselves that we use the word missing to cover issues that mean so much more than location not being known. Of the hundreds of families I've worked with, there's definite categories that everyone kind of falls into. Sometimes I say buckets and then I think that doesn't really fit very well with the kind of work that we do. But there's a definite focus, very small amount, on people who are missing because there is a homicide and their body hasn't been located. More predominantly, people are missing because they have either complex mental health conditions or, most importantly, because you can't confuse the two, that they're experiencing significant distress and their coping strategies to go missing and they die by suicide whilst they're missing. And then the other ones are misadventure, the bushwalkers who wander off the path, random things that happen where you go, how did that happen? The missing person space is full of never being complacent because you hear stuff that happens and you go, wow, never anticipated that, but there's always a story. And so when we capture all of those as missing people, It dilutes the message. It stops us seeing it for what it is. And it stops us seeing the potential trauma of being left behind. Because when we just say missing, you know, we're missing a set of keys or we've missed an appointment, it's not powerful. And there's no call to action. And there's no sense of, well, whose job is this? It's important that the police state that it's not a crime to go missing, but then it creates confusion sometimes in people's minds about, well, why do we only ever hear about missing people from the police?
Exactly.
So it's almost like there's a branding issue around missing persons.
There absolutely is.
It's like we need to do away with the old titles and name it for what it is. These are vulnerable people where we don't know where they are. And if we knew where they were, then we could provide them with better support. If we're thinking about the high volume of kids who go missing from care, so in the care of the minister and go missing, it's not a matter of just finding out geographically where they are, but it's investing in the time to say, what are you running from or who are you running to? So it comes down to that nuance of not just saying they're runaways, because runaway suggests wasting time, wasting resources, just doing adolescent behaviour. And that doesn't get to the core of the issue. So I guess what I try to do now is not focus so much on missing persons research, but pull out each of those themes individually and think, well, who do I need to be connecting with that's working with this population group but doesn't call them missing? Mm. And that seems to be where the interesting conversations are starting to emerge, particularly in the mental health space. People who go missing from psychiatric facilities are commonly called absconders. Absconders means just, you know, taking off from where you are. So we really need to understand the data better in order to think about how we develop a prevention framework. But it's at the very beginning of a long road. But I think the way that people can challenge themselves differently is not to talk about, I get really frustrated when people say, can someone suggest an entertaining podcast? I like listening to crime and missing persons. I think that it's important to acknowledge that we do consume this media in our spare time, but we need to listen out for the stuff that's going to challenge us in terms of what we think and feel and what we understand the situation to be about. I think it's taking every conversation where there's an opportunity to change someone's thinking and to do it. So just small scale things.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
All very doable with time. One of the things that I know you're very keen on making happen here in Australia, based on the success that they're having over in the UK with them, is return home interviews.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So Missing People UK and some other smaller counties across England are using returned interviews. Sometimes they're called post-missing interviews. They're an opportunity to get a sense of where the person was, what their experience was, were they a victim of a crime whilst they were gone, and what's going to assist them to reintegrate either back into their old life or to somewhere else that they're going to be safe. Often we think about that kind of missing found conundrum of they're here, great, let's just move on with it. And even in the counselling space, when I've worked with families of short-term missing people, I might get 10 phone calls a day from somebody and then I don't hear from them, and then 2 or 3 days later, I'll get an email that says, oh, it's all good, they came back, everything's fine. And I think having those meaningful conversations are really important, because people who go missing are more likely to go missing again. So if you miss that opportunity when they return to say, what could we be doing better so that this doesn't become part of your behaviour, so that it means that you can make safer choices, because there's also data that suggests that whilst you're missing, you're more likely to be a victim of a crime. So it's not just the reason why you went, but it's what happens to you while you're out and about and away from your normal social supports. So it's really about, and I'm in conversation with some law enforcement agencies about it at the moment, but it's really about deciding who's the best person to do those interviews. The UK experience is that police are sometimes not the best people to do it because of that sense of authority figure. There's no clear referral pathway in terms of this health service is tasked with doing that because that's their job, because missing is such a complex issue. if we do it online, are people likely to go, hey, I'm back from missing, I'll just sit down and fill in a survey for 15 minutes? The likelihood of that is quite low. Mm-hmm. So it's not actually about acknowledging that we need the interviews, but about how we deliver them so we can get meaningful data. Because there's nothing worse than acknowledging a gap but not being able to get something to help you build a picture of what a useful intervention plan is going to be.
Gosh, there are so many gaps in this space. It's pretty overwhelming. One area with that I think that you should have an interesting insight into is the way that media approach missing persons in Australia and the way that maybe you've seen that change in the last couple of decades.
Yeah. God, that makes me sound old.
I didn't mean to make you sound old, but, you know, you've been observant.
I'm a seasoned person. Wow. The media landscape has changed significantly, particularly with the introduction of social media. I'm a lover of social media. I learn all of my academic stuff from Twitter. I make all of my connections. They're my community that lives in my phone. You know, I wouldn't be here today if I didn't have those connections. I think that social media itself has allowed families to take ownership of the narrative in a way that they didn't have before. They had to rely on newspapers coming to them, taking pictures, and then seeing if it turned up in the newspaper the next day. The sadness that would come from families that would give it their all and have people in their house and taking pictures, and then something else happened the next day and their story was wiped. That's unfair to watch for families. I think that the media, as much as we might not want to say it, they have some community responsibility in terms of how they present cases. One of my students from University of Sydney, one of my honours students in 2019, did a January to September media analysis on all missing persons cases. So she managed to capture, I think that by excluding all the duplicates, because there's a lot of resharing of the same information, I think there was 187 individual stories about missing persons cases. And I don't mean stories, I mean about an actual missing person. So 187 incidents. There's 38,000 people that go missing every year, and clearly not everyone's going to have media attention. What she found from the analysis, she downloaded every single story and then did a content analysis of who were the dominant spokespeople in terms of who had precedence in terms of speaking on behalf of the missing persons investigation. Unsurprisingly, police were the dominant. Family members were second. Returned missing people were missing from every single media story. So if we have 97% of people who return, the media is not representative of missing person statistics. Unfortunately, there was also a slant to stories about Anglo-Saxon people going missing. And the only reference to, I think that there was two stories where like hikers had, there was a sense of misadventure and they'd eventually been located. The narrative was blaming and shaming of a waste of public resources. These people should pay back the money that was used to search for them. And I just think it's such a missed opportunity to balance it out. There's far more international literature about white women syndrome and the way that we report missing persons cases. The big inquiry at the moment into missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada has a number of recommendations around appropriate portrayal of people in the media who go missing and really honing in on their vulnerability rather than the sensationalist cases. I know that media don't have a responsibility to always ensure that they're covering all of the cases, but it would be nice to see it in some of the places. So I think that the media is continuing to grow alongside the missing person space. The emergence of podcasts and missing persons really gives an opportunity for families to tell their stories. But I also think we need to be cautious in making sure that in telling their story, they don't become the talent themselves, that these are true stories and they're lived experience stories, and that it's very difficult to bare your soul and to tell people about the very worst trauma that people have experienced. So I would like to see media continuing to include these stories, but also some support mechanisms around making sure that families know what the expectations are and also what their media hangover might be the next day after they've told all of these stories. Families are very protective of the missing person, as they should be, because they're their loved one. And I think making sure that they are comfortable with how much they share about the person, what the boundaries are around privacy, particularly around mental health presentations, particularly around medical needs, and particularly around previous traumas that somebody might have experienced. I see the value in sharing all of that with the police so that they can form an appropriate picture of how to search for someone. But I think, like we've seen over the years, that there's the mind frame guidelines around safe reporting of suicide in the media. I would really love to see safe reporting of missing persons in the media as well, to make sure that it's evidence-based and to make sure that we really look after the people who are giving the meatiness of the story by telling their stories.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I remember a couple of the articles on Dan in the early days used the word hunt.
Yeah.
And how upsetting that was for our family to feel that our son and brother was being hunted.
Yes.
Like a bloody animal. Like, imagine if he saw that and then he felt that he was being hunted. Media needs to be far more sensitive to the way that those types of words can affect a family in that vulnerable position.
And then, you know, I remember watching all of the media unfold when Dan was found. It's amazing to think how people perceive missing people as public property.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we've come along for the ride.
Now we're entitled to know every single
detail.
Give us the
stuff.
Yeah.
And the Morecambe family have been very open about that too, about they had to harness the community in order to help them find Daniel. But the negative aspects of that can ricochet in the lives of families forever. I also think that, and I'm quite sure it's impossible, but hey, you know, just put it out there. I think there needs to be safer moderating of social media pages, because we say to everybody, you know, don't read the comments. It's impossible not to read the comments all of the time. And the way that people speak about their armchair detective perspectives as to what happened to somebody, there's that lens where they don't perceive that they're talking about a real life person. So I think that, you know, you can't police everywhere that a story turns up, but the significant places should have moderation in place to make sure that families are not further traumatised, because families use media not because they don't have anything else to do, but because it's part of the sense of making sure they have done everything in order to locate this person. They don't have a choice.
Exactly. If you had a nugget of wisdom to pass on to families that are living with ambiguous loss, what would it be?
I'm never good at one piece of information.
Several nuggets. Go for it.
I think what I've learnt by walking alongside families of missing people, I never call myself an expert, because there is so much light and shade in what happens and why someone's missing. But I think what I've learnt revisiting families years down the track is that there is capacity to tolerate not knowing. It's uncomfortable and it's messy and it hurts. It physically hurts. And I know that from my own lived experiences. But you do have a stronger sense of suddenly the world reveals itself and you see the other people that are hurting and you become connected to them too. So there's a paring away of who you were and you become somebody new. And I think that the new person has the skills to tolerate not knowing. And you might not see that. And I was always very cautious with families not to sound patronising and say, I will hold on to a vision of what you will survive in the future because I know that you can't see it now. But families of missing people do survive and they do amazing things. And they do it all because they love someone. And so if you keep coming back to that central point, firstly, that you will survive. And second of all, it's because you have no choice but to do what you're doing and to feel what you're feeling and that it's all normal. And I think that that's the most important aspect.
Brilliant. Gosh, this is just, I'm so excited for the people that are going to hear you for the first time and have their minds blown, because every time I see you, and it's pretty regularly nowadays, luckily for me, I'm just in awe of the knowledge because it is so niche. This is a pretty weird space to operate in.
It's niche, but if you listen hard enough, the people that you work with will tell you stuff that you need to know. So you have a moral responsibility to do something with that.
Well, yes, not everyone is as good as you at doing that, though. I mean, that takes a pretty special person, and we are extremely lucky to have you. You are a rock star in this realm. And no, really, like when we rocked up to the International Missing Persons Conference in Liverpool last year, and I remember walking in next to you and I felt like I was the like younger sister of the prom queen, like rocking up to the prom, and everyone's just... Like, you're a big deal in this sector. You are.
I think the usefulness is I work very much alone in Australia. You know, I have my people that exist in my phone. And my kids are very interested in what I do, as long as it's secondary to everything else that they have going on. You know, it sounds dorky, but I've made lots of really awesome friends who are families of missing people. And when I go through difficult stuff, they text me and they say they're thinking of me. And I just think, wow, like not many people have a job where the people you work with that actually give a shit about you too.
Yeah.
And they do.
They do. I'm one of them.
Thanks.
I guess I should have maybe asked this earlier, but if you had to summarize what ambiguous loss is, how would you define it?
There's lots of terms for it that would probably make sense to a lot of people. But ambiguous loss in its rawest form is a sense of unresolved loss. It's a loss with no ending. It can sometimes be attributed to, you know, people might think about if you have a loved one who has a catastrophic brain injury and they're still here, but they're gone. About that disconnect between a physical loss and a psychological absence in some places too. So it's a confusing type of loss. It's a loss that doesn't fit within our normal framework of what we understand might happen to us in our lifetime. So it's probably not a very good snapshot, but it's defined as unending not knowing.
I'm excited to see how much better we get as a society at grasping that in the next few years. I would like to think that by 2025... Australian healthcare professionals will understand or at least have heard of ambiguous loss and maybe be prepared to support a family living with it, which is why I'm so excited that we are about to embark on this pilot program where you will be training clinicians around the country and internationally now, so that they are prepared to support families of long-term missing people.
I think all we need to do is make sure that people have in their back pockets that someone somewhere along your pathway as a health professional will turn up with this issue. And the best thing you can do is be reminded that you don't have to have all the answers, and don't ask them your curious questions. Keep them for yourself, but just provide them a safe space to talk about what it truly means.
Very well said. Gosh, Sarah, the curiosity. Yeah, people can't help it. I mean, there's so much intrigue. It's a human interest topic, missing persons. And that's, I mean, why I guess my first introduction into missing persons was through the media. TV shows mostly, movies. It wasn't a real thing. It was just something that happened in the movies. And we can't help but be curious. And I think people do naturally want to help, but they can't stop themselves from asking questions that they're not aware in the moment are insensitive and inappropriate. But the culture, I think, around this topic is that it is a storyline in the movies and in TV shows. And we are all inherently drawn to problem solving. And we feel that we can potentially help solve the problem, find the person. But it's so important that people remember that there are people that are left behind dealing with a very unique kind of trauma.
Very much so. And when I first started working, we had Google. I'm not that old. But the information wasn't readily available. So I always made sure that I met with families, talked through their story. And then in my personal time, I could go away and work out, hang on, do I know this case? Has this case been in the media? because you can be really pulled in to the mysticism of it all. And the families are living this day to day. There's no mysticism about it.
Exactly. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in and sharing all of this wisdom with us. It means a lot to know that you are here and accessible and are so freely sharing your knowledge with the world. So thank you.
No problem.
Missing Persons Advocacy Network is an unfunded charity run by me, Lauren O'Keefe. In 2016, we started a project that paired authors and artists with Australian families to tell their stories, to humanise missing loved ones beyond the stats they're typically reduced to. Though it grew to comprise murals, songs, sculptures, documentaries and coffee cups, our modern take on the old milk carton campaigns of the 80s, it began with a book called Two Short Stories. The What's Missing podcast was inspired by that book. These stories are but some of thousands. Help us help the usually unseen, unheard, forgotten community of those left behind by heading to our website where you can donate or get involved. mpan.com.au. That's mpan.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter using the same handle. MPAN Oz. That's MPANAUS. If you have a missing loved one, check out our guide at missingpersonsguide.com.